Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I wish to dedicate this program to Ray Goforth, Mayor of Uniontown. If her name had been Excelsior, she could not have more exemplified her life's Goforth attitude. She died in early August. And to Axel Edmund Meusen, who is 3 months old today, August 25th. He is the grandson of Paula Bukola Auersland and former Columbia River bar pilot, Captain Kel Auersland. Today's program is sort of an anniversary waltz, one of public orchestration, the other a personal rhythm. So I offer a disclaimer that opinions expressed are my own, and perhaps only my own, in all the melodical briny everywhere. Bridge to Nowhere. I have been looking through a pictorial book about building the Golden Gate and San Francisco Bay bridges. The photographs are by a father and his two sons, Gabriel, Raymond, and Irving Moulon, who were given a contract by the California state government. Raymond took most of the photos aloft of high steel workmen who built the bridges, anonymous fellows in workers' overalls who performed probably the most dangerous work in the world. Perhaps only skyscraper and dam builders work at equal risk. One photograph is more heroic in its modest simplicity than that of U.S. Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi at Iwo Jima. Like the four helmeted Marines, the four bridge workers are faceless beneath their wide-brimmed hard hats. They were hundreds of feet above San Francisco's wharves, weaving a catwalk of steel over the bay from which to string the large suspension cables. The caption of the photograph reads, "Workers appeared to be kneeling in space as they unrolled hardware cloth to cover the cyclone fencing and finished the catwalk." Rope handrails for safety were still to come when the photograph was taken. So were nets to catch falling workers who were afterward lifetime members of the Halfway to Hell Club. The Astoria-Megler Bridge, though not as monumental a job as the two San Francisco bridges, which were completed in 1936 and 1937, was a huge effort nonetheless, and bridging the 4 mile Columbia River was as momentous to Astoria as was bridging the Golden Gate, and completed the final break in a continuous highway from Mexico to Alaska. As it was with San Francisco Bay 30 years earlier, the river's ferry system was taxed to its limits in the 1960s, and over the protests of the ferry boat owners, the bridge, which had been an idea since the building of the Golden Gate, was opened 50 years ago in 1966. The Astoria-Megler Bridge over the Columbia River was opened up to automobile and truck traffic on August 27, 1966. The governors of Oregon and Washington, Mark Hatfield and Dan Evans, cut the ribbon, a rare period when both states were governed by high-level and capable governors at the same time, both liberal Republicans, a very rare species these days. The Astoria clowns, who had vigorously promoted building the bridge, were the first to drive its length. The Astoria-Megler Bridge was built at a cost of $24 million and one human life, a construction supervisor who was knocked off the bridge and his body never recovered. One woman remembers the early 1960s when the bridge was under construction as an unceasing pounding of pile drivers. When the bridge was completed, it was the final link of a continuous highway from Mexico to Canada, and it displaced the ferry fleet that daily crossed the 4 mile river. The bridge arches over the river like a huge museum skeleton of a prehistoric beast. Its body towers 200 feet over the water so that ships can pass underneath, and its long tail drops to just above the water for about 3 miles beyond the dredged ship's channel to the opposite bank on the Washington side, which is called Megler but there is no there there. Besides displacing the ferries, the bridge took a large segment of people off the river, which no longer plays a major role in the lives of those who live alongside as a result. Once and for a long time, the river was the main highway and means of livelihood for most of the immigrants who settled on its banks and built the small, busy towns on both sides of its lower length. For several decades, paddle-wheeled steamboats hauled supplies, merchandise, and passengers up and down the river. Timber companies floated huge log rafts from the decimated forest downriver to the deep water ports of Portland, St. Helens, Longview, and Astoria for shipment all over the world in square-rigged sailing ships, or to the large local fleet of timber schooners that worked along the Pacific coast from Canada to California. A majority of Astoria men and women were salmon fishers on the river, in the bays, and out in the ocean, or they worked in the fish canneries that once made Astoria the cannery capital of the world. All that has changed, and nearly all of it is gone, except for a few exhibits in the Columbia River Maritime Museum that acts as a time capsule for preservation for what is nostalgically called, publicly for commercial purposes, Astoria's golden era. The city suffered a series of economic disasters, primarily from careless overexploitation of the timber and fish resources that briefly made it rich and famous, and also from two calamitous fires that destroyed the downtown business core each time. Astoria was denied federal aid after the tremendous fire of 1922 and was forced to rebuild from its own resources, i.e., loans and bonds it might still be paying off nearly a century later. The fires changed the character of Astoria. Landfill at the riverfront replaced the wooden pilings and piers much of the downtown had been built upon over the river and which proved fatally flammable. The waterfront was reconstructed, a forest-like receding, although many of the charred pilings and burnt cannery buildings were left as they were instead of being cleared away. Overlogging of the type that cut down forests from Maine through the entire Northwest changed the environment, and too much silt from runoff down the cut-over mountains and hills poured into the river's tributaries and disturbed salmon cycles. Huge electricity-generating dams were built upriver that virtually wiped out the large salmon spawning runs. The fishing industry along the lower river dwindled until only a very few men and women are able to make a living aboard fish boats. The canneries that bought, cooked, and canned the fish are gone. The waterfront that used to be crowded with fish boats and cargo ships is virtually revamped into restaurants and motels and planned high-rise co-ops, shopping malls, and cruise ship docks. Initial hopes that the bridge would bring prosperity to Astoria took a long time materializing. The beach towns to the north and south have been the bridge's major benefactors, as well as local Washington shoppers taking advantage of Oregon's lack of a sales tax. The Astoria-Megler Bridge was early nicknamed the Bridge to Nowhere, though differences of opinion remain as to which side of the river was meant. It is not as old, nor anywhere close to the beauty of the delicate and decaying bridges on the southern Oregon coast. Those bridges, built by the legendary Condi B. McCullough, are celebrating 80-year anniversaries this year, as are the Golden Gate and San Francisco Bay bridges this year and next. A brochure about the Astoria-Megler Bridge, printed soon after it opened 50 years ago, said that the bridge is designed to withstand some of the toughest attacks of nature, gusts of wind of 150 miles per hour from the fierce Pacific storms that occasionally batter the coast still leave the bridge a safety factor. The concrete piers are built with an eye toward the river flood speed of 9 miles per hour, when whole trees sometimes are swept along by the raging water. The beautiful Art Deco bridges that were built on the South Oregon coast by Oregon State Engineer Condi McCullough in 1936 are essentially corroding by salt, yet only one bridge has been replaced so far, the one at Waldport in 1987, but the others remain in danger from salt air. The five remaining original bridges are Yaquina Bay Bridge at Newport, North Bend, Florence, Reedsport, and Coos Bay Bridges. The Alsea Bridge in Walport was replaced in 1987, but vestiges of the original remain in tribute to its former splendor. Condi McCullough designed 13 bridges along the Oregon coast when he was state engineer from 1919 to 1935. The oldest were the Old Youngs Bay and Lewis and Clark River bridges. Salt air remains their cancer. And that was the public anniversary. Now a private one. And I wrote it also. Meteor sinks. This upcoming Monday, August 29th, is 44 years since the fish boat F.V. Meteor capsized in the Columbia River Bar in 1972. There were four of us aboard, the skipper, two of us fish pullers and deckhands, and one who had never been on an ocean boat before. He was from Utah. We were on our first day of picking up Dungeness crab pots at the end of an extended commercial crab season that summer. We retrieved about 50 pots with trapped crabs in nearly every one. We had forgotten to take a large square box down from the upper bridge where we had stashed it while trolling for albacore tuna the previous couple of weeks. The captured crab gamboled about the wet deck, most likely looking for deeper water than the amount sloshed through the scuppers. The captain of the Meteor was a salt flint sea dog, a few years older than me. I had celebrated my 31st birthday that previous tuna run, watching the line skimming through the crystalline water on either side of the long trough our rudder dug out of the ocean, resembling a chalk line across the ocean surface. We bubbled for home with our 50 pots, past the dead light of Tillamook Head Lighthouse, a mile offshore on a huge rock, which has been turned into a columbarium for cremated clients, and also past the cow bone skull of the Peter Iredale that crashed ashore near the Columbia River Bar one stormy October night 110 years ago in 1906. We had to cross the same bar to get into the 4 Mile River, and even at its quietest, it is wildly spastic. The main channel on the river end of the bar was crowded with ships and boats bouncing in or out of the river through a portal of two immense water systems crashing head-on into each other every moment of every day, the past million years or so. We were actually through the worst of the wrestling waters when we suddenly were knocked sideways and lost a dozen crab pots overboard in the perpetual splashing of water against the rocks of the South Jetty. We managed to pull the pots aboard with boat hooks. The boat heaved like a rodeo horse. The skipper turned Meteor toward the main buoy line. Like most local boat operators, he preferred the shorter route alongside the South Jetty, but some days it's turbulent. Turbulence is the worst part of the inner bar. Two large ocean swells that ricocheted off the rocks of the North Jetty on the Washington side crossed the river straight at us before we reached the main channel. I watched as they came at us, lifting other boats, but setting them loose because we were their prey. I was certain of it, as I helplessly, almost hypnotically, thought as I stood at the wheel of the upper bridge and saw its anxious gyrations from the skipper below in the wheelhouse at my feet. The whole boat shuddered as the waves struck our port bow and wrenched us over and pushed us under like a massive army crushing its enemies as it passed over them. I followed the upended bridge as if I were riding an escalator into the river. For a few frantic moments, I thought the boat would roll completely over and drown me. But it stopped at the starboard rail and started settling from the stern like an old arthritic dog. By the time rescue boats reached us from the main channel, all four of us aboard were using the upended port side as a deck we tried to cling to as the turbulence wrecked the crippled Meteor. I saw the unfettered crabs slipping into the river. The stacks of crab pots on deck fell into the river, their red buoys joining others to form a necklace around Meteor. A brown and white albacore tuna boat came out of the channel toward us and hove to about 100 yards outside of us. A puker boat and a gillnetter came from the buoy line to get us off, probably radioed out by our sister, the brown and white tuna troller. They had to work at slipping past the mast that was aimed at them like a spear, and all of the topside rigging whipping around in the turbulent water. They followed one another directly at the wrecked boat and yelled for us to jump off the spasticating side planking that was now our upturned and rapidly disappearing deck. I was the only one left aboard Meteor when the boats with the skipper, my crewmate, and the water virgin from Utah backed out amidst the surge of Widowmaker masts and splashing ropes. The Meteor's boathouse, which had mostly submerged when the boat flipped, suddenly disappeared underwater, and I squirmed my butt onto the prow. I saw the puker boat circling for another run to get me. I stroked the wood planking of the bow and whispered my sorrow to the dying boat and apologized for everything I said to shame it in the past. I jumped for the small pointed bow that was directly in front of me the moment it began to turn aside to avoid collision with the nearly submerged bow of the dying Meteor. I had leaped out of airplanes strapped at parachutes, but that moment I jumped from the bow of that sinking boat was truthfully a leap into the unknown. I was fortunate to land in a tumbled heap on the deck of the puker boat. The Gillnetter fell in behind the smaller puker boat, and together we circled the wreck. Only the final inch of Meteor's bow was above water and part of the mast and a pole. Red buoys attached to sunken crab pots surrounded the boat and marked its death. I saw a shining white boat coming toward us, a Coast Guard rescue vessel from the Cape Disappointment Station, which I believe was the same 44-foot motor lifeboat that is prominently displayed in the Columbia Maritime Museum's window. My eyes barely caught the last of Meteor. A large swell rolled over its final tip of bow. When it passed, the boat was gone. A swirl of bubbles rose to the surface for a few minutes. I thought I felt the stern hit the mud and saw a surface boil of displaced water as the rest of the boat rolled over and collapsed on the river bottom. Loose boards floated amidst the ring of buoys. The Gillnetter and puker boat transferred we four refugees to the Coast Guard boat, and after salvaging a few loose boards where Meteor sank, the helmsman turned his craft toward the Washington shore. The Gillnetter and puker boat that saved us were by then anonymous among the crowded shipping in the buoy line. The brown and white tuna boat was also out of sight. Although the four of us aboard survived, our boat, FV, which simply means fishing vessel, Meteor, was listed on at least one chart as a major shipwreck of the Columbia River. Surrounding our boat on the list were nearly 200 other boats and ships, many of which lost their entire crews. I felt like a tantiwaste imposter that none of us aboard Meteor drowned. I posted a copy of the list with Meteor underlined in the box office of the Columbian Theater around the time the blockbuster movie Titanic was playing, and it remained on the wall for years. I wouldn't be surprised if it was still there. Perhaps my campaign poster for mayor of Astoria might still be framed on the wall of the Voodoo Lounge, which used to be the Columbian smaller theater, until Uriah Hultsey converted it into a dystopian vision reminiscent of Hieronymus Bosch. A woman once came into the Columbia River Maritime Museum while I worked there in the late 1980s. She sought information about sinking of Titanic because she was writing a novel about a large cruise ship disaster. She said she wanted to apperceive both the historical as well as visceral sense of a sinking vessel. I recommended her to the museum curator, but added that I had survived the capsizing of a much smaller vessel, and said that whenever the rail of a boat goes underwater, it is the same pathos felt on every deck, large or small. She came back a few days later and said she was haunted by what I said, and asked that I tell her the same story I have just finished telling you on the radio. I used to read a much longer version of this story on this program. And once KMUN station manager Doug Sweet suggested I take whoever wanted to hear the story to my house and read it to them there and stop wasting valuable airtime. And now I'd like to read something somewhat similar and much more calamitous. The coral reef die-off crisis is a capital crime, and Exxon fired the gun, by Bill McKibben. Coral reefs are probably Earth's most life-packed ecosystems. Those who have had the privilege of diving in the tropics know the reef as an orderly riot of color and flow, size and shape, which is why a white dead reef is so shocking, as shocking in its way as a human corpse lying on a street, which still takes the form of the living, breathing person it used to be, but now suddenly is stopped forever, the force that made it real suddenly and grotesquely absent. When a body falls on the street, the police come to investigate. Did this person die of natural causes, or was there foul play involved? When a reef dies, we ask the scientists, and this year they have told us the answer in no uncertain terms. The amazingly rapid die-off of a huge percentage of the world's coral reefs is not a sad but normal tragedy. It's a crime. Perhaps the fastest, most widespread crime of the global warming era. Vast swaths of coral were bleached this spring, much of the damage done in a matter of weeks, as a wave of warm water swept across the Pacific and west into the Indian Ocean. The immediate culprit was clear: the ongoing rise in ocean temperatures that comes from climate change. But that's like saying he was killed by a bullet. The important question is, who fired the gun? We know the biggest culprits now, because great detective work by investigative journalists has uncovered key facts in the past year. The world's biggest oil company, Exxon, knew everything there was to know about climate change by the late 1970s and early 1980s. Its scientists understood how much and how fast it was going to warm, and how much damage that was going to do. And the company knew the scientists were right. That's why they started climate-proofing their own installations. For instance, building their drilling rigs to accommodate the sea level rise they knew was coming. What they did not do was tell the rest of us. Instead, they and many other players in the fossil fuel industry bankrolled the rise of the climate denial industry, helping fund the think tanks and front groups that spent the last generation propagating the phony idea there was a deep debate about the reality of global warming. As a result, we have wasted a quarter century in a phony argument about whether the climate was changing. Had Exxon and its ilk merely told the truth, that argument would have been over. No one would have accused them of being climate alarmists. We would have gone to work to solve the problem. Our work would not be over by now, but it would be well advanced. The atmospheric level CO2 would not have topped 400 parts per million, and the temperature rise would not be flirting with 1.5 C centigrade. There would be coral bleaching, but there likely would not be a coral massacre on the scale we have seen this year, which means the victims should be angry as well as sad. The people who depend on the reefs for food and for shelter from the waves, the economies that count on tourist dollars, the people who take spiritual sustenance from the ongoing drama beneath the waves. The reefs can't be made whole again. If they recover at all, it will be slowly and in the face of ongoing warming that seems unlikely. But at the very least, the nations that sustained this damage should be compensated. Exxon and its brethren made record profits in the last decades of denial and deceit. That money should rightfully go to pay for the damage it caused and to build the energy systems that can power our lives without destruction. We need to remember that there is nothing natural about this horror. It was caused, as so many crimes are, by greed, and that greed is ongoing. Exxon continues to search for hydrocarbons and to reject even modest changes to its policies. That's why we have been wrapping crime scene tape this past week around those bleached coral heads, those dead staghorns. That's why we are taking crime scene photos with underwater cameras. That's why we are protesting on the reefs. We are not going to let them get away with murder. And that was "The Coral Reef Die-Off Crisis is a Capital Crime and Exxon Fired the Gun" by Bill McKibben, who is an author, environmentalist, and climate change activist. who was a recipient of the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel. He is a founder of 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement, which spearheaded the Keystone Pipeline resistance and launched the fast-growing fossil divestment movement. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, is regarded as the first book about climate change for general audiences. I would like to finish the program with a couple of poems. The first, by Arthur Honeyman. Genesis and Finale. In a timeless universe, on a certain speck of cosmic material, a phenomenon of individual activity evolved and separated from the oneness of natural forces, though the umbilical connection remained. Individuality destroyed timelessness forever, and it became a space problem, and it became a linguistics problem, creating and institutionalizing the meaning of existence, and the deities to determine the fate that must be accepted at all costs, for those synthetic boxes shall crumble and experience the ravages of synthetic flames. Poof, sometime about now, the nuclear hordes blast individuality into oblivion, mushrooming, vaporizing, timelessly again. And imperialism disappears from linguistic rescue. So much for punctuating the burst of the bubble from within. Poof. As for me, I row, row, row my boat briskly down the stream. Merrily, 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 life reigns supreme. And that was by Arthur Honeyman, who, as many of you probably know, was a world-class spastic. And he died at the age of 68 in 2008, and I miss him every day. And a poem by Bert Myers, And Still. People are rocks. They smile in the sun, then weep when it rains. Nobody's honest. Nothing matters. That's why I'm always adjusting myself, my chemicals, my complaints. And every day I enter the sacred car. I ignore the mangled man. I flee from those who are crumpled like a Kleenex in the hand of grief. I hear the broom that sighs as it waves farewell to the past. And still it happens. A tear falls from the sky and touches my cheek. A long war ends. People grow tall and radiant. Everyone is a streetlight that shines among the others. And that was And Still by Bert Myers. And this has been Michael McCusker.